This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Kenna.
Coming up, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee talks about Trump's inheritance of a vast domestic intelligence agency with extraordinary secret powers, and Trump's primetime rose ceremony a la The Bachelor, a hoopla pick for Supreme Court Justice. What's in store for our constitutional rights?
Now,
a suburban Quebec City mosque. 6 killed, 4 remain hospitalized. Our hearts are broken. The context of the attack was inescapable, coming from a rise in anti-Muslim rhetoric, behavior, and vandalism in Canada and the United States aimed at Muslims amid a heated debate about President Trump's executive order shutting U.S. borders to refugees and migrants from 7 mostly Muslim countries. Nevertheless, while debate has raged in the United States over whether to accept refugees from war-torn Syria and elsewhere, the Canadian government has become more open to people fleeing conflict in the Middle East. Trudeau has personally greeted some refugees who have entered the country and just the other day said he welcomed people who were rejected from the United States under Trump's order. But Trump's travel ban barring citizens of the 7 predominantly Muslim nations' entry into the U.S. has sparked protests throughout the U.S., and legal advocates for immigrant rights were able to get a national stay that covers those who were in transit and being detained at airports, an important first win. We're joined by Lee Gallant, Deputy Director of the Immigrant Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union. He is one of the attorneys who argued on behalf of those detained in federal court, and Lee joins us now to discuss how the federal courts have stood up on the issue and whether the order is being complied with. So how are we doing with the federal courts? The ACLU participated in, I believe, 4 of the 5 cases that were brought in relationship to the exclusionary order signed by Donald Trump. Tell us more about that.
Right. I think we're doing well so far. I think the federal courts have acted in the best traditions of our federal courts. If you go back throughout history, I think what you see is the federal courts generally standing up very strong. There's been at times they've been slower than at other times, quicker in other times, but generally speaking, they've stood up. And I think all of the judges who looked at the Trump order ruled against the government in some way or another. It's at this point only temporary, but I think it's very important. The Trump order went into effect late Friday afternoon. By Saturday night, I was arguing the case in Brooklyn Federal Court, and we got a stay by 9 o'clock, a nationwide blocking of the order. That's 28 hours. And so I think that's heartening.
I just want to, before we even talk about its enforcement, there are people like Asa Hutcha from Arkansas and folks like Christie who said, look, the only real issue is this, in fact, it is not a Muslim ban. This is to protect people against terrorism. It may have been inartfully rolled out, but there is no intent to discriminate or siphon out a particular faith-based group or ethnicity. Your thoughts on that and how you really are going to argue that there is intentional discrimination here and unconstitutional when you seek a permanent injunction. The case does have to go back to court.
Right. We do believe it's a Muslim ban. We believe the intent was to disfavor Muslims, to discriminate against Muslims, and to favor other religions, and in particular Christians. That is antithetical to our values. It's antithetical to the Constitution. Over and over and over, Mr. Trump talked about banning Muslims. At the end, he was told, oh, take out a few words and it'll be legally fine. It doesn't work like that. The courts won't be so easily fooled. They will look behind the words, of the executive order and see all of the statements he's made that it was a Muslim ban. The other thing I would note is, even on its face, it violates the First Amendment because it distinguishes between religions, minority religions, majority religions. There's just too much entanglement with religion, and more particularly, there's an anti-Muslim bias that was behind the executive order, and we believe we'll prove that in court.
I just want to delve a little deeper to help educate ourselves against what is the increasing rhetoric, certainly from those who are defenders of the Trump administration and the exclusion order, that the motivation behind the executive order was discriminatory. A Muslim ban wrapped in a really paper-thin national security rationale. Can they retool it a bit and distract from that reality? I mean, isn't it extremely hard to, and don't you have to show intent to discriminate?
Right. Well, we believe we will show that intent. We also, in the coming days, will be filing a suit with additional claims and where we do not have to show intent. But at the end of the day, I believe we will be able to show intent. There are times when there is very little evidence of intent and it becomes extremely difficult to prove it. I think this is not one of those times. We are compiling the record of his statements over, you know, the past months, and it's over and over being called a Muslim ban. And I think you saw Rudy Giuliani go out on the press and say, I told him just make a few word changes and it'll be all right. And, you know, that's too transparent. You can't just take out a few words at the very end and all of a sudden say your intent was completely different. So, you know, are we looking at a long battle in the courts potentially? Absolutely. Is it going to be easy? No. We're going to need to keep fighting. The communities are going to need to keep fighting. I think we're in a classic civil rights moment where the lawyers are going to have to be doing their work in court. The community is going to have to be coming out to support it. We're going to need the help from Congress. But we haven't seen this kind of combination of community support with the lawyers and all the sort of coalescing around different issues in a while. When I argued the case on Saturday night and came out of court, there were 1,000 people outside the courtroom, and that was just unbelievable. I think that's the critical thing, is that people were out at the airports, they were in front of the court, because the lawyers themselves in court are not going to be able to do it. It needs that kind of coalition effort.
The most recent protest in New York, which drew tens of thousands of people in support of their sister and brother immigrants, refugees, migrant mobility, was supported in full. Could you put a human face on who we are talking about and what they experienced, the actual hurt that was presented to the court? I mean, I heard about 1 5-year-old boy who was actually kept for maybe 30 hours and was actually handcuffed and kept from his parent. Tell us a little bit about who was subjected to and suffered damage from this exclusionary order.
Right. So it's people of all walks of life, all different people. It's older people, young people. It's people who helped our military. And, you know, the other side is trying to paint this picture of these scary individuals that we know nothing about. And take our two named plaintiffs in the case. One was an interpreter for the U.S. military. The other family worked for the U.S. military. I mean, they risked their lives for our country. They were vetted, obviously, for months and months, but beyond that, they worked for years with the U.S. military. They were given permission to come here. Their lives were in danger. They got on the plane thinking, I'm going to be able to come to America because I helped the U.S. military. They get off the plane, and the first thing they hear is, President Trump doesn't want you in our country. You know, this is not a situation where they've chosen a few particularly dangerous people to keep out of the country. It's a broad order that's keeping children out. People have helped our country, older people, and it's simply not right to sort of have this broad order, and especially because it's discriminatory against a particular religion, and that's something in our country we don't do.
Lee, what's the level of enforcement now, and do you have any idea how many people are actually still detained in U.S. airports or in legal limbo abroad or are precluded, for that matter, from travel abroad now, who were students and other people who were engaged in research projects and were all set to head off to various of the countries that are on the exclusionary list?
Right. Well, that's an excellent question, and it's precisely what we are working on, is trying to get that information. Unfortunately, we're not given access to everyone, so I asked for a list in court of everyone who's being detained. The judge ordered the government to give us that list. Thus far, we have not received a complete list, and so we're going to continue to press the government and maybe have to go back to court to get that list so that we can figure it out, because right now I cannot tell you precisely what's happening in all of the airports, how many people, and so we absolutely need that kind of transparency, because we will not take the administration's unilateral assertions about what's happening.
So the ultimate goal, of course, of the litigation is to challenge the legality of the order. The one thing that I think would be helpful to make clear is you indicate there is other litigation to follow. And when do you think you return to court for seeking a permanent injunction and the ultimate relief that is sought from that?
I think it'll be sometime at the end of February, beginning of March. Things are a little fluid now, but one of the things that we're trying to do is submit what's called amicus briefs in court, and that's people who want to weigh in and tell the court some different aspect. And it has been unbelievable, the outpouring of people who want to submit a brief. The universities want to submit a brief explaining what's happening. National security experts want to tell the court that this is not necessary. Law professors, faith-based groups, and so that's going to take a little time to put together, but I think we'll be back in court the beginning of March and hopefully get a ruling soon thereafter. But I expect both sides to probably appeal whatever happens.
So this is bound for the Supreme Court?
You know, it's always very hard to predict what will end up in the Supreme Court. There's too many contingencies, and of course the court decides what it wants to hear. But, you know, we certainly think the issues are very, very important and go to the heart of who we are as a country.
Can the administration do a kind of withdraw of some of the most overt or odious components of this document, which one of which was added by Bannon? We should also say that Rudy Giuliani, former mayor, was involved in some of the drafting, as was Peter King, I understand. What a group. Can they retool it a bit to take off the edge and thus kind of effectively moot your litigation?
They would have to retool it a lot, is all I would say. And, you know, we don't see any evidence of that. I mean, I don't think it would be a retooling. It would have to be basically a wholesale change.
And specifically, if you can, and I know that you've got a run and have had a very full plate in the last week, how do you encapsulate what is the most offensive component and the essence of this executive order, which of course suspended all Syrian refugees from entering the country indefinitely? Just give us some of the most odious components, just to refresh people's recollection or to make them cognizant of what it really is about.
Yeah, I think it's two things. It's one is we're turning our back on refugees. Every time we've turned our back on people around the world who are facing persecution or death, it's been a stain on America, and we've regretted it. Going back to turning around to St. Louis during World War II when Jews were fleeing, we've always regretted it. Turning our back on refugees is really something America should not do. And the other part is, of course, picking and choosing between religions and which ones we favor, and making these generalized assumptions that Muslims are dangerous and shouldn't come here. I think those are the two aspects that people should really be concerned with.
Well, Lee Gallant of the American Civil Liberties Union Immigrants' Rights Project, the ACLU promised us that when Donald Trump was elected president, if he tried to implement his unconstitutional and un-American policies, that they would take him to court. They did, and we, the people, won. Thanks so much for your work, for speaking to us, and we will keep in close touch with you and pay close attention to these really critical issues. The slice of the human misery that Trump has caused is just terrifying. And thanks for your work.
Thank you for having me.
And again, we've been speaking with Lee Gallant of the American Civil Liberties Union Immigrants' Rights Project, who argued of the stay that is now nationally in effect of the executive order of Donald Trump. And we are moving quickly and really continuing in some ways on the same theme. And we have Sue Udry, who is executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, Defending Dissent Foundation. Now, Sue, Donald Trump, possibly to distract the public from his immigration order debacle, shifted the discussion by, I think, orchestrating the announcement earlier than planned for his nomination for the Supreme Court at 8 p.m. in prime time. That was a departure from the standard procedure in recent years in which presidents have unveiled their nominees during the middle of the work day. All that was missing was a rose, a ceremony, right out of The Bachelor. Disappointing oversight for a president who was a reality TV star and has a rose garden at his disposal. But in seriousness, your concern about Neil Gorsuch and what he portends for our constitutional rights, and thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thanks a lot for having me. So Neil Gorsuch is a very polished, elegant lawyer who is able to turn a phrase quite elegantly. But underneath it all, he's a rabid conservative who is an originalist. He wants to interpret the Constitution the way that it was intended, the way that it was written back in the 1700s, back when Americans could own slaves. Slaves were not considered whole people. Women were not allowed to vote. Women couldn't own property. So that gives you a little quick picture of what we're dealing with this man.
I also want you to mention one of the cases that he was played a formative role in, or a formidable role, perhaps, is the case of the Hobby Lobby case, when we were which has everything to do with women's reproductive rights and his whole view of religiosity. And perhaps he forgot the separation of church and state. But your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's so troubling. The ruling said that companies can have religion and that they can impose their religious beliefs on their employees as far as restricting health insurance to not include contraception. So this, we're not even talking about abortion. We're talking about contraception. So Hobby Lobby didn't want their insurance to cover contraception, and this was as part of the Obamacare debate, and Gorsuch ruled with the majority that indeed you can impose your religious beliefs to at least this extent on your employees. And so when you take it, larger, the way that, really extreme conservatives are interpreting this idea of religious liberty is that, the baker does not need to bake a wedding cake for a gay marriage, that religious liberty doesn't mean that if you don't believe in gay marriage, you shouldn't gay marry, but that you should not have to do your job if it in any way participates in a gay marriage. And that you, as an employer, if you believe that gender is something that is determined at birth, you can discriminate against a transgender person in employment. So it's really twisting this idea of religious liberty to say that indeed employers can impose their religious beliefs on their employees.
The other thing I want to look at is Sally Yates was confirmed to her post as Deputy Attorney General in 2015, only after she had affirmed to the Senate Judiciary Committee that she would act independently from the President and vow to uphold the Constitution. Well, that same committee will get to vote on Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions, whose fingerprints are all over the executive order. Your thoughts, your concerns?
Exactly. So Jeff Sessions has been called, a Washington Post writer called him the intellectual godfather of all of Trump's hardline positions and his recent executive orders. And I think that's right. And I think that's obviously something that's got to concern us all. I think that on the one hand, Trump's firing of Yates certainly exposes him as an autocrat and as a man who will just accept no dissent. But I think that what it did, fortunately for us, is really stoke a fire underneath Senate Democrats who really need to be pushing back a hell of a lot stronger than they have been against Trump's nominees. So I think on the one hand, it was absolutely a despicable act on Trump's part. I think it might have served us pretty well to expose what an autocrat he is.
The other thing that I'm interested in, which I knew very little about and until we spoke offline, and that was the really kind of new cache of documents that have been revealed through The Interceptor that have everything to do with Trump's really inheritance of a vast domestic intelligence agency with extraordinary secret powers. I want you to talk more about that.
Yeah, this is where we confront Obama's legacy in a very unflattering light. People need to understand that my organization has been around since 1960, fighting to protect the right to dissent, which, of course, anyone in power doesn't want people dissenting against them, and so they use all the tools that the government has available to silence or to dampen dissent. And one of the tools that has been kind of a constant in our government since the early 1900s is the FBI and the way that the FBI can work in a clandestine manner to undercut dissent. And we thought, you know, people talk about J. Edgar Hoover and, you know, COINTELPRO, where they had, back in the 60s and 70s, where the FBI was blatantly trying to crush the Black Power movement and the Civil Rights movement and the anti-war movement. But what these documents from The Intercept show us is that the FBI has really very unlimited power to be able to infiltrate a religious group, such as the way they've been infiltrating mosques and Muslim student groups, and to also infiltrate the environmental movement, the anti-war movement, the Black Lives Matter movement. They need to have no evidence of or any suspicion of any wrongdoing within a group in order to infiltrate and see if they can really play the role of agents provocateur and sow discord and trouble within a movement or a religious congregation.
Sue, you're doing a lot to bring the work of The Intercept to light, these very, very important documents, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. What else can it do in terms of what is revealed by these terribly frightening, potent documents and powers being put at the disposal of the Trump administration?
What we've seen since Election Day is a massive uprising of people willing to be active, to be out in the streets, to do what they can do to resist the Trump agenda. And what the model of organizing that we pursue is to help local organizers work with their local governments to push back against the agenda. The Bill of Rights Defense Committee was founded in 2001 after the Patriot Act was passed, and we helped hundreds of towns, cities, counties, and even a few states to pass resolutions against the Patriot Act, which really pushed the boundaries of what local governments were willing to do to speak truth to the federal government. We think people need to start doing that again, and people need to really, if their city is a sanctuary city, make sure that their city sticks with that and then really expands the notion of sanctuary city to include the Muslim community, which may not be immigrants, but which is under severe threat from the Trump federal government, including the FBI, which Trump has said he wants, you know, to be surveilling every mosque in the country and is really stoking this anti-Muslim fervor. And so what local cities need to do, or what local activists need to do, is convince their cities and counties to have their police not participate in FBI operations, generally through the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which is kind of a local body that the FBI works with local police. They need to make sure that their local police are following their local laws, or they need to impose local laws that prohibit the police from infiltrating mosques without any suspicion of any criminal activity, and to prohibit their police from surveilling the Muslim community just because they're Muslim. So there's a lot that people can do at the local level to push back against the Trump agenda, and I think that's really an opportunity for us to do what we should have been doing anyway, even under Bush and Obama, but it becomes ever more critical with Trump at the helm.
Susan, your dream, who's going to be back with us many more times, so much to discuss. She is the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, Defending Dissent Foundation, has alerted us to this important material that is out there on the FBI, and we've got a lot of work to do, and with allies such as Sue, we will get it done. They say get back, we say fight back. Sue, thanks for joining us.
And thanks a lot, Mimi.
My pleasure entirely. Thank you all for listening. They say get back, we say fight back. We lend our hands to struggle and stay strong. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.